So, what do you do with that little cup?
Okay. I put it in the theater because I thought it would
be in the theater. Come up here.
Okay,
no. Thanks. So last week we did unit 21, wasn't it? 20. Oh, that's good moving through. And of course, unit 19 was the Vedic cosmos. And for that we did the group presentations and we did an exam. So there's no essays. So that brings us to unit 18. And unit 18, of course, is the activities of King Bharat. It is chapters 7 to 14. And at the end of, we had some questions which we can choose from. There's two personal application questions. One, draw general principles from the fall down of Bharat Maharaj and discuss the relevance of these principles in their own practice of Krishna consciousness. Give references to verses and purports in your response. Or, select points from Jad Bharat's teachings to Maharaj Rahugana and discuss how they are particularly relevant for your own personal application. Give reference to chapters 11 and 12, verses and purports in your response. And preaching application, there's a couple of questions. Draw general principles from the incident of Goddess Kali killing her worshippers and discuss their relevance for preaching. Give reference to chapter 9, verses 11 to 20. And the final preaching application question. Identify at least four statements from chapters 13 and 14 verses and purports which appear to be contradictory to popular contemporary thought. Explain how you would present these to an audience of non-devotees in such a way as to be tactful but not compromising our principles and values. To me, I think, you know, personally, I like the one about Kali, killing her worshippers. Discuss the relevance for preaching. I've come across a few Kali Vaibhava worshippers lately and managed to track them to Prabhupada's Sankirtan mission. But any second thoughts on that?
The last one also looks good.
Yeah. identify four statements from chapters 13 and 14, verses and purports, which appear to be contradictory to popular contemporary thought. And that's also good. Who has... have you identified some statements yet? Chapters 13 and 14, all texts and purports. You want to quickly rip through that?
It's a lot of points, I believe. There is the metaphors of it in Dungeon, the heaps of them.
There's a lot there.
A lot there.
I mean, it is a good topic, I agree. How many classes do you think we may have to devote to that?
Yeah. I think it is both are good. Third is more focused because it's only...
Yeah, only one. I think just for the ability to be able to have a discussion all together in one class. I mean, we have discussed all of these at length, and we can redo that. It would probably take us a couple of classes to actually even just discuss all the points in 13 and 14, and then another class just to finish off. So I think it'll be good to get all these essays done and dusted so that we can move into the next teaching assignment. So all those for question three, say aye. Harry Ball. Again. All right.
What is question three?
Yeah, question three. Draw general principles from the incident of goddess Kali killing her worshippers and discuss their relevance for preaching. Give reference to chapter 9, verses 11 to 20. 10 texts. Because... here, of course, we have discussed all of those different points at length over many, many classes. But our main goal here is learning the ability to write an essay. You read something, you do your class, and then to just go home, write the essay, come back next week and hand it in. That's the main thing, developing that talent. So it doesn't really matter which one of these, because we've covered all the text, but I think so as we can have the focus on essay writing, I think, in general we might stick to the simpler tasks. So that's all right, so let's do that. Now, I've got my laptop here. I'll just put that in the ground. Does anyone have the book? Or can anyone get me the book? I didn't bring this book. And it's... Yeah, you've got it? Yeah? So, okay. So, do you? Yeah, you okay? Okay. So much easier than flicking through a laptop. So I stayed at my mother's place. I was going to go home, and then I ended up not going home.
What chapters again, Paul? Are we getting?
Chapter 9.
Chapter 9 and 10.
Yeah, and verses. Just chapter 9, verses 11 to 20. So we'll read through those. It's good to see some, good essays are coming in.
Yeah,
But, mostly. And that's what we want to see. So, it's a very simple process. You know, once you get a flow, study the chapter again, read it thoroughly in the first place, of course, which we've all done, so we, you know, get that proper understanding. Then, you know, it's just going through again and picking out the main points, which, you know, that helps to jog our memory of the whole topic. The good thing about studying it very intensely in the beginning is that when you just go through, everything else comes back, you know, very quickly. And then you can isolate those main points. And then, because this is a preaching application question, you want to write the essay and demonstrate the ability to, one, see the potential for preaching in this topic, and then to present the topic in a way that shows the skills of a preacher. You know, someone able to, you know, handle Prabhupada's teachings and Srimad Bhagavatam in a way that is attractive and you know, acceptable to people, not confronting, not outlandish, you know, presentation. So, you know, it's a preaching skill. We want to develop that. So first we're going to look at those points. Text number 11. Jabhrat used to work only for food. His stepbrothers took advantage of this and engaged him in agricultural field work in exchange for some food. But actually he did not know how to work very well in the field. He didn't know where to spread dirt or where to make the ground level or uneven. His brothers used to give him broken rice, oil cakes, the chaff of rice, worm-eaten grains, and burned grains that had stuck to the pot, but he gladly accepted all of this as if it were nectar. He did not hold any grudges and ate all this very gladly. That really mistreated him. They really mistreated him, didn't they? Imagine if that's what you got at Prashad and you went up Prashad. Yes, we've got some Prashad for you, Ganga. There's a little bit of things stuck to the pot. Things at the bottom of the bin after they threw the rest out. It's like Raghunath Das Goswami used to. But the cows wouldn't eat. Then he would take that, wash it and eat that. So of course through this we really learn the, you know, what it means to be a devotee, what we're living up to. We like to call ourselves devotees. Very nice. But this is activities of real devotees. Paramahamsa. Prabhupada quotes the Bhagavad Gita 2:15. Sarva dukkha sukham dhiram somritattvaya kalpate. So, and this is what I love about Prabhupada's books, is that although it's very, very elevated activities of the highest sannyasi person, its foundations are always in the Gita, you know.
And if you complain and say that they were pure devotees, then Srila Prabhupada will just say, why don't you become a pure devotee?
Yeah. When one is callous to all duality, the happiness and distress of this material world, one is fit for amritattva, eternal life. Bharat Maharaj was determined to finish his business in this world, and he did not at all care for the world of duality. He was complete in Krishna consciousness and was oblivious to good and evil, happiness and distress. As stated in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the material world, conceptions of good and bad are all mental speculations. Therefore, saying this is good and this is bad is all a mistake. One has to understand in the material world of duality, to think that this is good or that is bad is simply mental concoction. However, one should not imitate this consciousness. One should actually be situated on the spiritual platform of neutrality. So, well, let's start with one. We can see here the exalted nature of a devotee.
The interesting thing was, he was completely oblivious to all this, but when King Raghubana insulted him, he felt something and then he dissociated himself from that. But how is it that he didn't feel all this, but he felt the harsh words of King Raghubana, which were comparatively, it would seem a lot less harsh than all this?
Well, you know, it shows that although he's not, as Prabhupada says here, it says, Bharat Maharaj was determined to finish his business in this material world, and he did not at all care for the world of duality. So, it's not as if he doesn't notice the ups and downs in one sense, but he's so fixed up in finishing up the business of Krishna consciousness that they, you know, purposely don't notice, and sometimes becoming so absorbed, then they're so absorbed in Krishna consciousness that at times they really do not notice at all, even quite extreme conditions. When they do notice, they purposely don't care too much for what they've noticed, and sometimes they don't notice at all. But in the case where, taking exception with Raghubana, it would be for Raghubana's benefit, not his own, you know, that he's taken the time, trouble to notice and to point out. It's like, sometimes when you're preaching, people who don't know proper etiquettes in dealing with devotees or Brahmins who may have come to their home or what have you may not offer, any facility. Or sitting comfortably, or drinking, or what have you, and because you're there and you're feeling very satisfied to, be taking Prabhupada's mercy here and there, then you may not care to notice, but it's not as if you don't notice. And then sometimes when you're chanting and doing kirtan, then the difficulties that you go through, you don't notice. So, sometimes you do notice, and then sometimes you're so absorbed in the service that you don't notice. But at times you may point out something to the people you're preaching to for their benefit. It's nice to supply a mat or to sit on a piece of cloth or, some water or something like that. So it's like that. Certainly not for himself, that's for sure.
Which Chandra Thakur writes in that regard that...
What's that?
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He writes in this regard that Jada Bharata was preaching to in all circumstances.
Yeah.
He understood that these people, they are in passion and ignorance.
Yeah.
Those who are trying to kill him and this is relative. They are not going to represent him anyway.
That's
so
right.
He just left them and
yeah.
He gave his association by not reacting.
Yeah.
Just accepting what they gave, just
yeah.
Gave his darshan.
Yeah.
And both got benefit, they got the benefit of being with him for a long time,
yeah.
Their relatives.
Yeah.
And they were going to kill, trying to kill him. They got liberation because, next life they will get liberation because they got the darshan of Kali.
Yeah.
Whereas when he came to Rasgana, he was in goodness, he was a jnani because that's why he was preaching in that manner.
Yeah.
He was trying to.
So he
understood, if he
yeah.
speaks, it will help him.
That's
so
right. Yeah. He reciprocated in different ways.
Yeah.
It was really down to preaching.
Yeah.
You know, that sometimes you say something because sometimes you don't say something, someone hasn't offered you a mat to sit on, but you know that you're better off not to point out a fault in them because they may get some movers, you know. You just sit on the ground. But other times you know that they'll listen and they'll. But yeah, but they're not, in any case, it's not for himself that he notices. So sometimes, they notice, sometimes they don't because they're so absorbed spiritually. And of course, it's important to understand that, these saintly personalities do notice the good and the bad, but they're really, a whole lot of it is so insignificant that they don't allow anything to affect their Krishna consciousness. It's important to understand that because, we shouldn't think of Prabhupada as someone who just floated around in it, without any pains or worries, He felt the thirst, he felt the hunger, he felt the heat, he felt the cold, he felt, the hard work, the lack of sleep, he felt
the
all
pain
of those
of
things.
The heart attack, the pain
yeah,
of the
he
heart.
Felt the pain, he felt these things, So, but they don't care about it. They're just, the business is going back to work. And sometimes for the sake of preaching, where there's an opportunity to where someone may listen and they may speak something, or even criticise them, or even chastise them, if they think they can handle it. So, let's start off at this point anyway. The devotees are very exalted personalities, and for their own self, they're exalted persons, their mind is fixed on going back to God in Krishna consciousness. And therefore, they don't care about the devotees. They're indifferent. Write that word. You see that comes up a lot with Kaukushala Das Prabhupada. Because sometimes what happens is that some people try to imitate advanced devotees and they actually become averse to something. Trying to imitate detachment, they quite often become anti-something. So like we have that problem, that's one of the things that we face in ISKCON, where men become averse to women. It's a form of imitating detachment. Indifferent is a whole different thing. Whether they're there or not makes no difference. I'm not against it, it makes no difference. Whether that devotee is in a man's body or a woman's body in that sense, wouldn't matter to me, they're doing nice service. So it's sort of indifferent. That's different to being adverse to something which is actually an imitation of detachment. You know, this word indifferent is a good word to use. Also, for instance, you know, the dualities of this world. We wouldn't say that they're ignorant of them. They don't notice anything. You know, their devotees have always got Krishna in their head. They don't know, you know, the good and bad that I'm going through. You know, sometimes the children of our movement think of their parents like that. Yeah. I'm going through all these problems, you know, as a good like that. Their parents don't even know. So it's indifferent. It is different to being oblivious or averse to something. So. Text number 12. At this time, being desirous of obtaining a son, a leader of dacoits who came from a Sudra family wanted to worship the goddess Bhadrakali by offering her in sacrifice a dull man who is considered no better than an animal. Well, they obviously thought that he was as, you know, about the same equal value as a goat. So, but you know, so because this is a preaching assignment, so there's a few strong words. Any Bhadrakali worshippers in here that we have to?
Low class men.
So we've got Well, the women think they've got it tough. Look at this. You wouldn't want to be... I'd rather be a woman in this kind than a Kali worshiper. Look at this. Okay, Kali worshippers. Now, how's it going to be if some of them come to the temple and say, I was reading your book. I'm not very happy with you. Okay, what are they? They're low class. Sudras.
And for the fulfillment of material desires.
What's that?
For the fulfillment of material desires.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll kill an animal or man. In their worship. You know, because this sort of thing reminds me a lot of ISIS. You know, they worship Allah. By, you know, killing, men, women and children, thinking that he will be, you know, satisfied by that worship. So, you know, this mentality, you think, oh, yeah, we saw that in India, you know, thousands of years ago. What's going on in the world now? In movements like ISIS. You know, for the fulfillment of material desires, you know, telling of what they consider human beings who are no better than animals, they consider, and they would kill them, you know, as an offering. This will satisfy God. It's the same mentality.
Where does it happen from?
ISIS. Daesh, you know, the Muslim group cuts people's heads off. And, you know ISIS, you know?
ISIS,
yeah. Or Daesh, something to call it. I don't know. It's the same mentality.
Muslims sacrifice humans?
They kill humans. And they feel that that is pleasing to God. That is, it is actually a part of their worship.
To kill a human.
Yeah, part of their worship is that, you know, that they, as a sign of their devotion and service to God, they feel that killing humans will satisfy God, Allah.
All Muslims, or is it just that particular?
That particular, you know, there's some particular. Well, now they've split up in a whole bunch of different groups, but no, Muslims don't think like that. But people who, in the name of the Muslim religion, there are many like ISIS and others, they think like that. You know, the Muslims don't. You know, at all. They, you know, they reject this. But my point is that, you know, sometimes we read these things in the Bhagavad Gita and we think, oh, you know, what are we going to preach about Kali? There's no one running around going, Kali, 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 with that. Don't you, you know, spread Kali, you know, in our city, you know, as long as it is. But this mentality is, you know, very, very strong around the world, and in Australia, people are already, you know, people with this type of mentality are now even in Australia, and they like to kill, you know, policemen or, you know, so many different people. It's that same mentality that, you know, it is really they're fulfilling their desires, and, you know, but underlying that, their own personal interests, and they worship God in such a way that they will be benefited materially and with a material concept of heaven, and etc. But part of it is that it is okay to kill and sacrifice and offer in the name of pleasing God, you know, to slaughter different human beings who they may consider to be no better than animals. You know, this is happening today. So it's the same mentality, same form of worship. I know sometimes I, you know, just doing different ceremonies, and when I present the Bhagavad Gita as, you know, very wonderful, sophisticated teachings meant for the benefit, you know, of everyone, and, you know, it's teaching a very joyful and, you know, beneficial way of worshipping the Lord. And sometimes I mention, you know, that we don't, it's, you know, if you compare this, what Krishna is asking us to do, to offer him a leaf, a fruit, a flower, water, to what others have to do. In other words, if you want to show yourself to be a good Muslim, that's what they say, not that Muslims are like this, but then you have to join this war and, you know, be prepared to kill, you know, and then, you know, your religious sentiments will be recognised. You know, if you, you know, for a devotee to be recognised, be eat more prasadam and distribute more prasadam. But there is a mentality in this world, if you want to be recognised in your religion, you have to come and kill. Otherwise you're doing nothing. Don't call yourself a Muslim. You said they're doing nothing.
There seem to be two points here.
Two coins?
Two points. Like, yep. Low class men, yep, worship demigods like goddess Kali.
Yeah.
And then the second point is sometimes to do this secular human being before the deity.
Yeah.
So it seems to be talking of two kinds of worshippers.
Yep.
One who worships Kali without sacrificing a human being, but
yep.
they're still low class and less intelligent.
Yes.
And one who goes even to the other extreme of sacrificing a human being.
Yeah.
So even if a person is a worshipper of Mother Kali, the point is it doesn't. They can say, "Well, we don't sacrifice a human being." But Srila Prabhupada's purport is saying that even if you don't sacrifice a human being to worship Mother Kali,
is still
less intelligent.
And low class. So, the leader of the dacoits captured a man, animal for sacrifice, but he escaped, and the leader ordered his followers to find him. They ran in different directions but could not find him. Wandering here and there in the middle of the night, covered by dense darkness, they came to a paddy field where they saw the exalted son of the Angira family, Jalabara, who was sitting in an elevated place guarding the field against the attacks of deer and wild pigs. The followers and servants of the dacoit chief considered Jadbharat to possess qualities quite suitable for a man-animal, and they decided that he was a perfect choice for sacrifice. Their faces bright with happiness, they bound him with ropes and brought him to the temple of the goddess Kali. The followers and servants of the dacoit chief considered Jadbharat to possess brought him to the goddess Kali. Purport. In some parts of India, animalistic men are still sacrificed before the goddess Kali. So, here Prabhupada, he's writing this in the 70s, so he's saying still happens. I'm not sure if it's India or might be Africa, where they, you know, the albinos. They have the white pigment of skin, even though they, you know, they should be dark by nature. And they have to live with the lepers, because that's the only place where they're not hunted and killed. People offer them in worship as like a. And then they use their bones and different things in potions for curing illnesses and things. That still goes on today. And the only place they can live and be protected is amongst the lepers. And even there, they have to have armoured guards, protecting those villages like that. So here, Prabhupada's also acknowledging that, as far as the Kali are worshippers, in some parts of India, animalistic men are still sacrificed before goddess Kali. And that's probably still going on to this very day. However, such a sacrifice is only performed by sudras and dacoits. The business is to plunder the wealthy, and to become successful, they offer an animalistic man before the goddess of Kali. It should be noted that they never sacrifice an intelligent man before the goddess. In the body of a brahmana, Bharat Maharaj appeared deaf and dumb, yet he was the most intelligent man in the world. Nonetheless, being completely surrendered unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he remained in that condition. It did not protest being brought before the deity for slaughter. As we have learned from the previous verses, he was very strong and could have very easily avoided being bound with ropes, but he did not do anything. He simply depended on the Supreme Personality of Godhead for his protection. There's a verse by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Marabi rakabi ya ichatahara nichidas pati tuya adhikara. My dear Lord, I am now surrendered unto you. I am your eternal servant. And if you like, you can kill me, or if you like, you can protect me. In any case, I am fully surrendered unto you. So, we'll put up here, the devotees are exalted, fixed in Krishna consciousness, the difference in the dualities, and the
depend upon the protection of the Lord. So, depending on Krishna's protection is one of the six items of surrender. The Kali worshippers, they kill animals, etc. And animal-like humans. And it means non-intelligent.
Elsewhere in Srila Prabhupada's purport, he says that I think either this is in Bhagavad Gita chapter 1 or 2, and it's also there in other purports of Srila Prabhupada, but he says that one should fight for one's life, because one's life has been given for self-realization. So why is that, seems to be contradictory here, when Jalabharan didn't see even attempt to save himself, because was it that he'd already achieved perfection, so there was no need for him to continue to?
Yeah. So, we're a preaching movement, so generally we teach people to perform their usual duties. And do that in Krishna consciousness. And, you know, the usual duty of every human being, of course, you know, your first duty is actually preserve your own life. That is your first duty to yourself. So, Jadbara, as you know, that although he engaged in some preaching, generally he was just immersed in the, Paramahamsa, platform of just personally being fixed in Krishna consciousness, not really taking notice whether others are properly doing their duty or not. You know, it was just really so. Part of his process is really just personally for him. He was. Let me just think of Krishna, and if Krishna wants to take me, then he will. And if Krishna,
but still, Arjuna,
protects me.
Prabhupada always says that Arjuna depended fully on Krishna, but he still fought.
Yeah,
it's Krishna who did everything, but Arjuna still fought.
Yeah. Krishna wanted him to fight. Krishna, Arjuna tried to imitate Jadbharat. And Krishna said, "That's not for you." He says in the third chapter of the Gita, do your duty and without attachment, without any sense of proprietorship, and without any lethargy, while thinking of me. So he, several times he asks Arjuna, "You do your duty as a kshatriya, and you do it in Krishna consciousness." And that's the message of the Gita, which we preach to people: is you do your duty, you do what you would usually do, but you do it in Krishna consciousness. You do it in a way that you're thinking of Krishna, and you're doing it in a way that Krishna would be pleased by doing, because it's according to religious principles. The Paramahamsa has no duties to perform. They're above sannyas. They're above all the varnas and ashrams. They don't even perform the duty of a sannyasi.
But their bodies.
They have no duty to perform.
But their body still belongs to Krishna to be used in his service.
Yeah, that's Paramahamsa. That there is all the usual duties of. they're not obligated to perform them, even to look after their own body. Everyone else in the Varnas and the Ashrams, you know, they do their duty, but they do their duty in Krishna consciousness, and Arjun was the perfect example of how to do that. I mean, generally that's what, you know, how we preach, you know, that you follow Arjun, you do your duty and you do it in Krishna consciousness. Don't try to imitate the Paramahamsa. If, you know, Krishna taught that process of follow Jadbharat, if Krishna told Arjun to follow Jadbharat and don't worry about any duty towards your own body, your family or society or anything, then everyone would be serving Krishna by imitating Paramahamsas. Then imagine the trouble we'd be in. So, you know, it's better that everyone follows Arjun and does their duty and thinks of Krishna than to follow Jadbharat. And Arjun tried to follow Jadbharat and Krishna wouldn't allow it. So, but, you know, but we have to know what the platform of Paramahamsa is, and therefore we're seeing the example of Jadbharat.
I mean, not performing brahminical duties, that makes sense, because he was in a completely different level. Because by Varna and Ashrama, he was a brahmana. But in terms of not even protesting when, or not even saving his own life, because his body was still Krishna's, to be used in Krishna's service.
Then if Krishna wanted it, Krishna would save it. In other words, if Krishna was ready to take Jadbharat back to the spiritual world, do you think Jadbharat would be able to stop him? Krishna's ready to take me, and you know, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to keep this body going a little bit longer, Krishna. It's not going to happen. You know, he's quite confident in Krishna. It's not neglectful. I mean, if you're confident of Krishna's protection, or that he will take you when he's ready, you're not being neglectful. You know, when you get married, you say, you know, you say, this person, I put my faith in this person. So, you're not being neglectful by not taking shelter of other men for their protection. Krishna says, I'll protect you. So you're not being neglectful by, you know, accepting his position as the personality of the body. But, you know, it's a good point because you know, this is part of understanding the Bhagavatam, isn't it? That although we're learning from Jadbharat, you know, generally in ISKCON we don't imitate or, you know, Jadbharat, you know, we follow more Arjuna. Than Jadbharat. Although the internal process of surrender of Jadbharat we follow, just like we follow the mood of surrender of the gopis, but we don't imitate the gopis. You know, the gopis accepted Krishna exclusively, no other, not even Narayan. We follow that. The gopis would spontaneously, you know, serve Krishna in any way he wanted without the least hesitation. We try and follow that. But we don't run around trying to kiss Krishna and, you know dress up as gopis. You know, we don't imitate, you know, certain things. We chant 16 rounds, you know, regularly. the gopis, you know, didn't sit down and chant. You know, they just chanted all day. So they thought of Krishna always, and we follow that process. How do we do that? By chanting 16 rounds. So we follow Jad Bharat.
By depending on Krishna. But we don't imitate by being inactive.
But, so he is following the process of a paramahamsa and depending on Krishna. And we are following the process of a preacher and depending on Krishna. So the dependence upon Krishna we learn from Jad Bharat, and it doesn't change, but we apply it as a preacher, not as a paramahamsa. We follow the principles of the gopis, Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, they follow the principles of the gopis, but not running around Vrindavan, you know, like a gopi, but, you know, as sannyas, preaching, strict, regular principles. But their internal mood is, you know, the same. So, the proper application of the Bhagavatam. And of course, you know, it's these things which, you know, as some of you had mentioned, and, you know, some of you may mention as you do your presentations. So you take careful note. You've got a presentation coming up in the next few weeks, yeah? I'll take that as a very firm yes. Who else we got? Surya, yeah? He's taking all this in. Good.
I'd like to see one or two people presenting just to have a feel of it. I missed out lectures already last 5 minutes I saw. So if I could see someone
presenting. It's only for 5 minutes, I think.
Not for 5 minutes, only a couple of minutes.
You do yours first then?
Yeah.
If I get second chance, I'll do first, Prabhu.
What's that?
If I get second chance, I'll do first, Prabhu.
Okay. So let's write something up. Let's write something on the board. Make it look like we're making progress. What are we getting to write? We got that. He depended on Krishna. Okay, let's read the next verse. Look, it is part. Let's just summarise that what we just said there, because it's a preaching exercise. This is one of the points of this section. And that is that we follow the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, so the instructions of Krishna under the direction of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. Which is appropriate for Kali Yuga. And of course, a lot of people will read Prabhupada's books read so many different things and then quote them, but unless they're reading the books and practicing the teachings of Krishna under the umbrella of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, unless they do that, they'll not be able to actually implement the Bhagavad Gita, the instructions of Krishna properly. It'll be very faulty. It'll be ineffective. And it may cause themselves and others trouble. And that's what Rupa Goswami says, that one who follows the scriptures, one who engages in devotional services without reference to the scriptures, it becomes nothing but a nuisance to themselves and society. And the scriptures declare, that we should follow this Sankirtan movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. After this, all the thieves, according to their imaginative ritual for killing animalistic men, bathed Jadbharat, dressed him in new cloth, decorated him with ornaments befitting an animal, smeared his body with scented oils, and decorated him with tilak, sandalwood pulp, and garlands. They fed him sumptuously, and then brought him before Goddess Kali, offering her incense, lamps, garlands, parched grain, new grown twigs, sprouts, fruits, and flowers. In this way, they worshipped the deity before killing the man-animal, and they vibrated songs and prayers and played drums and bugles. Jadbharat was then made to sit down before the deity. Report. In this verse, the word Sravidina, according to their own ritualistic principles, is very significant. According to the Vedic Shastras, everything must be done according to regulative principles. But here is stated that the thieves and rogues devise their own process for killing an animalistic man. The Tamasic Shastras give instructions for the sacrifice of an animal like a goat or buffalo before the goddess Kali, but there is no mention of killing a man, however dull he may be. This process was manufactured by the dacoits themselves. Therefore the word Svavadina is used. Even at this time, there are many sacrifices being conducted without reference to the Vedic scriptures. This is Prabhupada saying, even now this is happening. For instance, in Calcutta, recently, a slaughterhouse was being advertised as the temple of the goddess Kali. Meat eaters foolishly purchased meat from such shops, thinking it different from ordinary meat and taking it to be the prasad of goddess Kali. The sacrifice of a goat or a similar animal before the goddess Kali is mentioned in Shastras just to keep people from eating slaughterhouse meat and becoming responsible for the killing of animals. The conditioned soul has a natural tendency towards sex and meat eating. Consequently, the Shastras grant them some concessions. Actually, the Shastras aim at putting an end to these abominable activities, but they impart some regulative principles so that gradually meat eaters and sex hunters will be rectified. Very interesting. Okay, so there's some very significant points, and of course, this would be one of the main preaching topics of this chapter, because you may need to flip the board a minute, but let's put this okay. So people tend to worship according to their own imagination. That's worship. Disregarding the scripture. This is the main thing that's going on in this chapter. And the main thing that we see happening around the world is where religion, which is meant to gradually restrict and reduce the tendency for sex and killing or meat eating, where religion is being changed to give greater access to sex and mediating. And therefore, and what this is why the philosophy that everything is one, it's all one. All is one. God is within everyone. God is everywhere. Here, because from here, basically what we're doing is going from here, and eventually when we get to the bottom, we'll have lots of meat and lots of sex. So let's start from God and work our way down. All this one, this is where they're headed. All this one, God is within everyone, God is with. Okay. Krishna is God. Oh yes, and so is Kali. Kali is God. Anyone else? Ganesh. And Shiva. And Sai Baba. And blah blah blah. So some of these personalities allow meat eating. It's within their religious principles. Ceremonies and worship Chandi. Is it? Chandi, the goddess of wine? Another form of Kali, isn't it? And the wine in there. So, basically, by not discriminating the person under the Godhead, but just falsifying the philosophy God is within any particular deity, really, you gradually get to the deities that allow some meat eating and some wine. And then if you just, the next thing is a very cunning device. What you do is you take a little bit from each, a little bit from Kali, a little bit from Ganesh, a little bit like this. So basically, as soon as someone says, no, you can't do this, you quickly swap to the next deity, which says, yes, you can do like that. And when they say no, you quickly swap to the next deity. And gradually, you get to the point where you've taken enough from each of them where you can have as much meat and sex as you like. And this is really and a bit of wine. Let me get the wine to help digest the meat. And to get suffering. This is where philosophy really leads today. So, But, you know, it stems from this, you know, there are two things here. One is who to worship. You know, who do intelligent people worship? That's the first question.
What is the purpose of the worship? Because if the purpose of the worship is to achieve material enjoyment.
So, and why? You know, for what motive? Really where we have to catch them as preachers. We have to bring them back to this. Who intelligent people, for what motive, for what process? I mean, a simple conversation will catch most people out. You know, if you ask them, you know, if you mention these points, that are these all black, or they just got different colours on the outside to trick me? Let's have a look. Oh, there's an actual. Generally, what happens is that if someone is born somewhere, that determines their worship. So I was born in a particular family. I was born in a certain part of India. We worship Kali, we eat meat. Someone else said, where were you born? I was born somewhere else in India. We worship Vishnu, we don't eat meat. I was born in China. You know, I was born in Australia. You know, I was born in the Outback. So according to where you're born, people just worship. So that's like saying that you know, I was born in a desert, and you know, therefore, you know, we eat grubs and, you know, birds and, you know, certain things like that, because there's no facility to grow crops. So now I've moved from the centre of Australia. I'm living in Melbourne. When I want something to eat, I go out looking for grubs and, you know, climbing trees, killing birds, trying to eat them. It's okay, you're born somewhere, but now you live right next to a supermarket, you can go and pick out what you want. See? So it doesn't really make sense, does it? You know? But people follow this. People will follow this for thousands of years. I was born somewhere, this is what my parents were, like that. And today, I have no idea what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, but they've done it, things have changed. If I ask why we do that, I don't get an answer. That's what most people follow these days. But an intelligent person would ask, actually, what is the best form, you know, why do you worship this person? And are you worshipping this person to go back to the spiritual world? Are you worshipping this person for material facilities? Are you worshipping this person for knowledge? Like that. So, you know, the question is why? And if the only answer is because mum did it, mum and dad did it, then it's really, you know, within a couple of minutes, I think most people would see that they're doing something really stupid. You know, I mean, if you have, and I know that because I've had this conversation with a lot of people. It really works well, and people are just like, you know, embarrassed because that's actually what they're doing. You sort of tell it as if you're telling them about someone else, so you don't put them on the spot. But they're thinking, "Oh, I hope he doesn't know that's actually me." And that.
So how do you do it? Because there's a way of doing it also.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you just sort of mention, you know, it's just like in passing that, you know. Because what happens is you read a verse in the Gita and you explain, Krishna tells you why you do something, and then you say, you know, it's funny, but a lot of people, just as they're born somewhere, they just worship because, you know, mum did it, they don't even know, you know. So you get into the conversation as if you've met people like that, and then they, you know, sometimes they'll sheepishly sort of say, well, you know, I think I'm in that category too. But they get, you know, start the realisation. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there are more sort of, say, you know, there are people who do very well out of being preachers of philosophy, and they know that it's very unpopular to try and stop people from eating meat. And therefore, they'll stick with these sorts of philosophies. It's all one, God's within everyone, God is everywhere, you know. Otherwise, no one would listen to their talks, no one would go to them. So, you know, in order to justify any stupid thing that people are doing, they come up with all this nonsense philosophy like that. That means everyone who's, you know, will go and listen to them. So, yeah. It comes down to, a lot of people, it comes down to some very basic sense gratification. Now, on the other hand, what is our preaching? You know, to sort of, people may say something, yes, meat eating is allowed in our religion, and, you know, wine is allowed, and, you know, some of the different things. So people will say that. And of course, we preach against that very strongly. We have a tissue. Anyone got a, is there a tissue? No. Oh, there's a bit of paper. Yeah. Sure.
Are you
next
one?
Oh, okay. Do you want me to write it back out there?
Indifferent.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dualities.
What's that?
Dualities.
Yeah, in different to dualities. So, of course, we'll come back to it. How are we going for time? Because we want to come back to it, but... Okay, we better start closing. What's that? I'll read this next verse while we're doing that. At this time, one of the thieves, acting as the chief priest, was ready to offer the blood of Jabra, whom they imagined to be an animal, man, to the goddess Kali to drink as a liquor. So they were going to offer the blood of Jabra for goddess Kali to drink. He therefore took a very fearsome sword, which was very sharp, and consecrating it by the mantra of Bhadra Kali, raised it to kill Jabra. You know, it's sort of funny because you think, is someone so stupid they're going to, you know, get his blood and offer it to, you know. But you have to take this seriously because, as we said, people are still doing such crazy things. All the rogues and thieves who made arrangements for the worship of goddess Kali, you take that one side off, not the other. And when All the rogues and thieves who had made arrangements for the worship of Goddess Kali were low-minded and bound to the modes of passion and ignorance. They were overpowered by the desire to become very rich. Therefore, they had the audacity to disobey the injunctions of the Vedas, so much so that they were prepared to kill Jadvarat, a self-realised soul born in a Brahmin family. Due to their envy, these dacoits brought him before the goddess Kali for sacrifice. Such people are always addicted to envious activities, and therefore they dared to try to kill Jadvarat. Jadvarat was the best friend of all living entities. He was no one's enemy, and he was always absorbed in meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was born of a good Brahmin family, and killing him was forbidden, even though he might have been an enemy or aggressive person. In any case, there was no reason to kill Jadvarat, and the goddess Kali could not bear this. She could immediately understand that these sinful dacoits were about to kill a great devotee of the Lord. Suddenly, the deity's body burst asunder, and the goddess Kali personally emerged from it in a body burning with an intense, intolerable effulgence. Report. According to Vedic injunctions, only an aggressor can be killed. If a person comes with an intent to kill, one can immediately take action and kill in self-defense. It is also stated that one can be killed if he comes to set fire to the home or to pollute or kidnap one's wife. Lord Ramchandra killed the entire family of Ravana because Ravana kidnapped his wife Sita Devi. However, killing is not sanctioned in the sastras for other purposes. The killing of animals is in sacrifice to the demigods, for expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is sanctioned for those who eat meat. This is a kind of restriction for eating meat. In other words, the slaughter of animals is also restricted by certain rules and regulations in the Vedas. Considering these points, there is no reason to kill Jadvarat, who was born in a respectable, highly exalted Brahmana family. He was a God-realized soul and a well-wisher to all living entities. The Vedas did not at all sanction the killing of Jadvarat by rogues and thieves. Consequently, the goddess Bhadrakali emerged from the deity to give protection to the Lord's devotees. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, explains that due to the Brahman effulgence of such a devotee as Jadvarat, the deity was fractured. Only thieves and rogues in the modes of passion and ignorance and madness, and maddened by material opulence, offer a man in sacrifice before the goddess Kali. This is not sanctioned in the Vedic instructions. Presently, there are many hundreds and thousands of slaughterhouses throughout the world that are maintained by a puffed-up population mad for material opulence. Such activities are never supported by the Bhagavad school. Intolerant to the offences committed, the infuriated goddess Kali flashed her eyes and displayed her fierce curved teeth. Her reddish eyes glowed and she displayed her fearsome features. She assumed a frightened body as if she were prepared to destroy the entire creation. Leaping violently from the altar, she immediately decapitated all the rogues and thieves with the very sword which they had intended to kill Jadvarat. She then began to drink the hot blood that flowed from the necks of the beheaded rogues and thieves as if this blood were liquor. Indeed, she drank this intoxicant with her associates, who were witches and female demons. Becoming intoxicated with this blood, they all began to sing very loudly and dance as though prepared to annihilate the entire universe. At the same time, they began to play with the heads of the rogues and thieves, tossing them about as if they were balls. Report. It is evident from this verse that the devotees of Goddess Kali are not at all favoured by her. It is Goddess Kali's work to kill and punish the demons. Goddess Kali Durga engages in decapitating many demons, dacoits and other unwanted elements in society. Neglecting Krishna consciousness, foolish people try to satisfy the goddess by offering her many abominable things, but ultimately when there is a little discrepancy in this worship, the goddess punishes the worshipper by taking his life. Demoniac people worship Goddess Kali to obtain some material benefit, but they are not excused of the sins performed in the name of worship. To sacrifice a man or animal before the deity is specifically forbidden. And the last text, number 19, when an envious person commits an offence before a great personality, he is always punished in the way mentioned above. Sukadeva Goswami said then said to Maharaj Parikit, O Vishnu Dutta, those who already know that the soul is separate from the body, who are liberated from the invincible knot in the heart, who are always engaged in the welfare activities for the living entities, and who never contemplate harming anyone, are always protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who carries his disc, the Sudarshan Chakra, and acts as supreme time to kill the demons and protect his devotees. The devotees always take shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord. Therefore, at all times, even if threatened by decapitation, they remain unagitated. For them, this is not at all wonderful. Purport. These are some of the great qualities of a pure devotee, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. First, the devotee is firmly convinced of his spiritual identity. He never identifies with his body. He is firmly convinced that the spirit soul is different from the body. Consequently, he fears nothing, even though his life may be threatened. He is not at all afraid. He does not even treat an enemy like an enemy. Such are the qualifications of devotees. Devotees are always fully dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the Lord is eager to give them all protection in all circumstances. So,
they're meant to decrease the propensity to act for the body. And that principle is universally accepted in all religions. When you get persons with strong material goals to enjoy the body, they choose religions which give that opportunity, that's number one. They'll choose that religion which allows that type of bodily enjoyment they want. They want to eat meat, they'll become a Christian, a Muslim. They don't want to eat meat, and they might take to Buddhism, isn't it? Someone really against eating meat, they're not going to become Muslim because they're going to become a Buddhist or a Hare Krishna. But, you know, according to that, but if they have the strong goals to eat meat, and you say, I like everything about the Hare Krishna Buddhism, but I'm not going to join because I like to eat meat, so therefore I'm going to go for this one. So it actually, you know, it affects their choice of religion. And the other thing is that they choose parts of religion. They give that opportunity to enjoy the body. You know, some rules, some regulations. And
where those parts of religion are not there, they may add or delete. You know, they may add parts to add parts. Now, when they do that, what happens is that when they commit sins in the name of religion, they're not excused. Especially when it causes harm to innocent living beings, innocent animals or humans. Especially sins towards, let's just say innocents. You can expand it on that. You know, cows, they're not aggressive. They're not going to come and fight you, and trample your house down, and they're doing so much benefit to society. Priests, women, children, Someone commits sinful activity, this is going on in the world now.
So
they'll not be excused, they will be punished. Now, an interesting thing here, I'll come back to you, is that especially when there are serious offences before great personalities or personalities dear to the Lord, it says they're always punished in the above way mentioned. So, having the head cut off decapitated is the sign of a very sinful death from previous sinful, and it doesn't happen. We had one spiritual master, one of the original 11 or 12 spiritual masters, Jayatirtha Maharaj. You know that? Tell you the story. It's interesting how people don't know these things. But, so he was a disciple of Prabhupada. Very nice devotee. And Prabhupada, therefore, said he can become a spiritual master. When I used to go to Mayapur, I used to serve a lot of these personalities because I used to get there before the servants came. Anyway, he was in England. He was the guru of England and that whole part of the world. And what they started doing was having kirtans. And during those kirtans, evidently there was a lot of intoxication, LSD and all sorts. And they would roll, the kirtans went for days, hours and days and days. Devotees all rolling around the ground, in apparent ecstasy. There was a lot of drugs involved. So it was highly, offensive to Prabhupada. And I think someone associated with one of his disciples come in. I think he was on the sign and everything and just cut off his head. The guru, Jyotirtha. You never heard, I'm surprised, more surprised about the devotees who don't know about the history of Islam. But yes, that was it, you'll hear the story one day, so at least you'll hear it in relationship to the philosophy. It's a very, something very serious is going on. Here,
how do
trashing religion or religious principles. So as a very serious thing. So that was what was happening even in ISKCON.
But how could he deviate so much from Srila Prabhupada's teaching?
Yeah. You know, it was a very difficult time when Prabhupada left, you know, and, you know, it's the same thing, that basically, you know, we choose, you know, there what they did was they actually chose the part of Prabhupada's teachings which dealt with very elevated devotees experiencing ecstatic symptoms and things like that. And, you know, the taking of drugs sort of infiltrated the whole thing and just seemed to be, you know, that as long as they were having ecstatic symptoms and chanting Hare Krishna, then the drugs probably, you know, that were justifiable. If we're experiencing such an elevated platform of devotional service, who else in the world is chanting for 3-4 days on end? Everything stopped. There were no services being done. There was no sankirtan. You know, it was just everything, the whole thing, everything stopped. There was just kirtan. So I guess they just justified, they just accepted those parts of our philosophy which, you know, satisfied, you know, that basic, you know, subtle or gross sense gratification that sometimes is, you know, sought after. But there are many other examples, you know, these things happen, so I mean we're preaching to the outside world, these things happen within ISKCON as well, you know, where we choose part of the philosophy that tends to, you know, support some sort of sense gratification that we are, you know, desiring, you know. Because, you know, some people, you know, sometimes there are different marriages that have separated and, you know, one devotee taking another devotee's wife, probably thinking, well, you know, that'll be better for my Krishna consciousness and better for her Krishna consciousness, and you know, the other person come in, found them both in bed and shot the guy and killed him. There was one devotee up in Dawn who he used to be a nice devotee here. Someone ran off with his wife, it wasn't a devotee. And then this devotee went and beat the hell out of that guy. And the guy knew a little bit about her philosophy. He says, you're supposed to be non-violent. And the devotee said to him, according to the Bhagavad Gita, I could kill you. Because you've taken my wife. I've just given you a beating. But, you know, even within our movement, we have to be very careful, you know, of what happens, you know. This is just a propensity which is in each and every one of us. It happens in ISKCON and it happens in other religions. So we should be a little careful pointing the finger, but you know, this is the beauty of the Bhagavad Gita. You read the Bhagavad Gita and you see all the different rules and regulations, and so clearly it is stated throughout the Gita that it's meant to regulate the mind and senses, and to get you off the bodily platform and onto the platform of the soul. And, you know, the proof that you're on that platform of the soul is that you actually can control the mind and senses. And that can only be done by thinking of the Lord and serving Him in a regular way, regulated way, and in a gradually spontaneous way. But if we allow... There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter or fourth chapter, that, you know, one should avoid, you know, contact with the senses because they're stumbling blocks in the path of self-realization. You know, something like that. What's that? Yep. Not take place, yeah. The determination of devotional service doesn't take place. But there's other ones as well, that, you know, this lack of regulation of the mind and senses leads to, you know, obstacles in the path of devotional service. So this is actually the teaching of all religions. This is, you know, people may, if you look in here, you won't see that this is just a Hindu thing. This is Christianity, this is, Judaism, this is, Muslim religion. It's the same principles, that we have to, that all religions are teaching that there are rules and regulations and they're decreasing the propensity to just live in this world for the sake of the body. Every religion is teaching that we're actually supposed to live for the pleasure of the Lord on the spiritual platform and, just avoid lust, greed, anger, like that. All religions are teaching the same thing. But if we allow, our material goals, the greed and the lust and the anger, to eclipse our intelligence, then we will choose a religion or parts of a religion or add parts and then even commit sins in the name of religion and basically have our heads chopped off. or suffer. But it's a very serious thing. It's serious to commit sins, but when they're committed in the name of religion, that's more serious. Because that really misleads people. It's a very serious punishment for that. And it will not be excused. So this is our preaching to people who are doing that in the name of Kali worship and, kosher meat and, this, that and the other that everyone's doing. They say they're eating their meat and they say, oh, it's our kosher. We killed the animal, we killed it nicely, it says in our scriptures, don't eat the blood of an animal, so we drained all the blood of the animal out and then we ate it. so many things. That won't be excused.
But in the Christianity, they believe that Jesus taking all their sins, so they engage in the animal killing. What happens to them?
Well, as Prabhupada says, it's a Sunday Monday business. That the idea of someone forgiving your sins is that it gives you the opportunity to have a second chance. That I've done something terribly wrong, and I should be punished, in many lifetimes for those sins. Out of love and extreme compassion, someone has forgiven me, and therefore, I have the opportunity to, take up a different path in life that takes me back to the spiritual world. And show my appreciation to the person who has forgiven me. Then go out and sin again, do all the same sins again, means that the person, really has not appreciated the opportunity given to them. If someone is, someone says, I've given you the opportunity, because I've forgiven your sins, I'm giving you the opportunity to come back in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there is no killing. If you want to kill to eat, you have to stay here. So if someone kills to eat, then they'll have to stay here. It's one of those sort of statements that when you say to a person, they can realise the stupidity of what they're thinking. If you say to them, there's no killing in the spiritual world. No one dies. There's no killing. So you don't kill to eat in the spiritual world. You only do that in the material world. So if you're attached to that, you'd have to stay here. To go back, you've got to give up the ways of the material world to go to the spiritual world. That's what it means. So, it doesn't take much to really dismantle that sort of nonsense that, Jesus accepting our sins means that we can just keep eating and go back to the spiritual world. It's just not going to happen. In fact, what will happen is that what they have to, and this is our preaching, we actually have to teach them that sins done in the name of religion are worse than ordinary sins. Someone knows that something is wrong and they keep doing it, then that is worse than an ordinary sin. And they will not be excused because it pollutes religion. It goes against the work of God or Jesus or Muhammad. They're doing so much work, and then here's someone proposing to be religious, giving religion a bad name. So do you think God's going to accept that? He's going to have to, you know. So it doesn't take much, really. It's really common sense. It's not a matter of, you know, well, this is our faith and you have your faith. It just doesn't make sense what people are doing. You know, and if they've got a little bit of intelligence left, you know, devotees should, first, we should, you know, we have to understand the purpose of religion. And then you can very easily see that if someone is using religion to increase, you know, meat eating, wine and sex, they're abusing religion. We know that straight out. So then they'll have so many excuses. And it's up to us to just very clearly understand that you may have so many excuses, but it doesn't make sense. You know, basically, you know, they can say that, but all religions believe this. We have to give up lust, greed, anger, envy. Every religion will understand that. So if you say to someone, when you eat meat, is that because of your own lust or desire to eat meat? In other words, if your religious scripture said, don't eat meat, would you have a problem with that, or do you really like meat? You really, you know, oh, I've got to have the meat on my plate. You know, if the religious scripture said don't eat meat, would you have a problem? I probably would, because I really got to have some meat. So that, well, then it comes down to that person's lust. So therefore, they're going against their religion, because every religion preaches against these things. If someone is doing something, you know, according to their greed and their anger and their envy, you know, it's not that difficult to actually distinguish between someone who's doing something according to the religious principles and someone who's actually satisfying their lust, greed, anger and envy. And when they understand that there's an element of lust, greed, anger and envy in what they're doing, I mean, a sincere person who's following religion and understands that, you know, I feel within myself a real greed, you know, or a hatred, and I'm supposed to be a religious person, I don't like that. You know, a sincere person would say there's something wrong with what I'm doing. You know, it shouldn't be there. You know, it's sort of against what I believe. So, you know, there are intelligent and sincere people out there to speak to, and it's not that difficult to distinguish between someone acting according to these things or say, camouflaging them as religious principles. And if they do that, the other thing is you can just ask them, have you ever done this experiment where you look at yourself and you look, you know, understand what lust, greed, anger and envy are and see whether you're actually acting on that or just purely according to religious principles. Have a look at it. Do you examine yourself? But anyway, this is our preaching, and it's very effective. Actually, people respect the Hare Krishna principles all around the world because of the fact that we have these principles and can very strongly distinguish between the nonsense that goes on in religion. So, and of course, you know, we have to point out here that sins in the name of religion are not excused, especially sins to innocents and you know, the saintly people. Yeah, it's top of the list as far as, you know, people want to vilify saintly persons, cause them trouble in the name of spreading their religion. That will not be excused. And of course, we understand that because there is so much of this going on, that's why Kali comes in the form of these movements like ISIS. That is the movement empowered by Kali to punish the sinful people who have been doing this for many, many years. And as long as people, which they are doing this sort of thing, they will never get rid of ISIS. ISIS is the reaction to this sort of sinful activity in the name of religion. That's, they think it is a political movement. It's not a political movement. It's the material energy in the form of Bhadra Kali cutting their heads off, giving them punishment suitable for their crime. Just like, as long as, Prabhupada would say, as long as you kill the animals in the slaughterhouses, your children will be killed in war. But now, they're not just being killed in war, they're having their heads cut off in so many atrocious things, because they're not just killing the animals, but a lot of it is being done in the name of religion, and so much, this is increasing more and more. And therefore, even killed in war, there's more, you know, gruesome punishment. So this is all the movement of the material energy allocating the sinful reaction. You know, so as long as people follow these nonsense, you know, worship of eating meat under all these different guises in their religious movements, killing innocent animals, especially cows, then there will be war The horrors of war will equal the horrors of the sins committed in the name of religion. That's our preaching. You know, one time I was in Perth, and the Hare Krishna movement had done thousands and thousands of these, they were like a newspaper thing, and it was all about the myth of the innocent citizen. So what it meant was that people are crying out that, oh, you know, so many people being killed in wars, and, you know, and there was this big protest in Perth. There was thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people went there to protest for peace in the world. And we had these, somehow they piled up and we could never distribute them. And I decided we'd go there and distribute them there. So the myth of the innocent said, so, you know, what happened was, I said to the devotees, I said, what we're going to do, we're going to move through the crowd, we're going to give them out in about 5 or 10 minutes, and then we're just going to disappear, which we did. And then, you know, people started reading them, you know, they're doing this, and they're actually saying, you know, that these wars are the reactions of your own sinful activities, you know, the myth of the innocent citizen. You could see them from a distance, you know, getting angry, you know, but they all read it, but, you know, it's a fact. They want peace, but, you know, if they do this, they're not going to get it. All right, we'll just leave and give a little bit of food for thought. Hopefully you get some nice essays. And, of course, because there are a lot of people who are fearful of war and the way the world's going, if there's an actual solution, they may listen to it. Because no one else has got a solution except this. This is the only thing that makes sense.
But very few people, like you said, when you actually gave those pamphlets, they became very angry. So...
Yeah, well, now we're learning to write essays and just gently give them to people in discretion.
But if you...
I was just having a bit of fun that day.
But if you were talking to someone, how would you...
Just like we've done now, if they're, you know, as much... The thing is that you become, you know, first of all, you understand our teachings, like what we've done, and that's why you write the essays. And then when you see, you know, this sort of thing coming up, people afraid of wars and this and that and the other, we understand that this is, you know, the reason. It's somehow just saying enough that they can hear at that time. You may not be able to say everything we've said, but sometimes you can make one or two sentences and it's enough, and I say, yeah, you know, and then not go on with it and then move on. And other people will sit with you for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Some people sit with you for an hour. So you just, as much as they will hear, you, and then you give them a little bit of shout them. And that's it. Yeah. All right.
Thank you.